Gentlemen, good morning. I'm Patrick Cronin, Director of Studies here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I want to welcome you to another CSIS policy forum. The subject today is Iraq. I suspect this will not be the last forum we'll do on Iraq between now and the election even though our scholars are busy writing reports and books and traveling to the region. It's important to take opportunities like this to address some of the immediate questions as well and to inject some of the strategic insights they've been trying to think through for a larger audience, and we certainly welcome all of you this morning. The title of the program today, Iraq's on the precipice of failure with a big question mark, certainly underscores the apprehensiveness that a lot of Americans feel about the direction of the war in Iraq, and we couldn't have three better speakers than we have this morning. Certainly if I were still in a policy position, I would want to consult all three of these individuals, starting with Anthony Cordesman, who is the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy, a prolific author on Middle East security issues. And we've asked Tony to get us started this morning with some of his insights on where we are headed in Iraq. Tony?
Thank you very much, Pat. I think that perhaps the most important point that President Bush made last night was that we are not in a post-conflict situation. We are involved in a war, and that war is going to play out not between now and June 30th, but certainly if any of our plans work over the course of next year, and it will probably go on into early 2006. And the casualties and the costs and the challenges are going to have repeated cycles of terrorism and violence before we can put an end to the insurgency. I think another point that he did not mention, but perhaps we need to bear in mind, is it's one of four wars we are now dealing with. We are also fighting a war in Afghanistan, whose outcome is uncertain. We are dealing with a broader war on terrorism, where I think even the most senior United States officials will say that while we are able to wrap up the senior leadership of al-Qaeda, it is far from clear that more terrorists are not being created than are being killed or captured. And we have the problem of Pakistan. And although I will leave this subject to John and others, the fact also remains that we are caught up in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the fact that everything we do in Iraq is seen in the Arab and Islamic world as coupled to what is happening in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and our images of fighting and occupation in Iraq are invariably shown with images of Israel's occupation and fighting. I don't argue how fair this is, but I think it's important to lay the context, because when we talk about Iraq being on the precipice, we face much broader challenges. And let me begin in dealing with Iraq by very briefly saying that President Bush made some points last night that I think are important to remember. One is the strategic priority for success. It doesn't matter how we got here, we are here, and the priority for success is very high. It is equally important to remember that in spite of the problems of the last few weeks, we still do not face a major insurgency in terms of actual military opposition. As nearly as we can determine, the fighting in Fallujah really affects something on the order of 1,000 active, dedicated insurgents at most, in a city whose population is at most 300,000, or less than 1% of Iraq. This is not a massive military issue, and even if we look at the broader insurgency, it seems to be concentrated in areas that take up about 6% of Iraq's population, and it seems to involve between 10 and 15,000 insurgents. We don't know what Sadr is going to mean, but it is important to remember that while people have talked about massive crowds, as yet I have not seen any television coverage or films that indicate these crowds are particularly massive. His militia is on the order of 5,000 to 15,000 members at most. And these are important demonstrations, and they are important problems, but they do not reflect, at this point in time, a massive amount of the population. I think it is still possible that over time we can get a compromise among the Iraqis between the UN and our efforts, and there will be a government on June 30th. It is certainly right to say it will be a disaster if we delay sovereignty. The Iraqis may be able to do it, but if we do it, it will fuel every conspiracy theory in the region. And finally, President Bush said something that is very important to remember. The success or failure of this effort ultimately depends on the Iraqis, not on the United States, not on the UN, and not on NATO. If they can make this system work, if they can reach a political agreement, if they can agree on economic reform, then the country will move forward. If they can't, nothing we do from the outside can resolve the situation. At the same time, I think any observer of last night's speech has to say that we have to recognize the risks are far higher than the president portrayed, and a great many more mistakes have shaped the situation. Perhaps one of the most critical was the failure to prepare for the security and nation-building missions before, during, and immediately after the conflict. Most of the problems we face today would have been far smaller if we had ever had a realistic assessment of what needed to be done in Iraq once Saddam fell. As a result, neither we nor the exiles we brought with us have, in any classic sense, political legitimacy. That is a critical problem in this country. It is also true that the public opinion polls do not say that the majority of Iraqis are with us. I've heard people quote this, but those polls are based on ABC News and Oxford Analytica polls, and to be blunt, they simply do not produce those results any more than the Zogby survey did earlier. A majority of Iraqis want the coalition out. The question is really when and under what conditions. When you look at Iraqis by group, 37% of the Sunnis polled supported violent attacks on coalition personnel, and 12% of the Shiites. That is not a small minority. And the risk that the events of these weeks or of the future could catalyze large amounts of Iraqis into violence against the United States or make it untenable for us to go on with the nation-building effort is a real risk, and it will be a continuing risk, not only after the new government takes over, but during the creation of a constitution and during the election. It is also true that a majority of Iraqis are not seeking liberty or democracy. Right now, what a majority want is a strong Iraqi leader for at least the next year. These are the polls the president drew on. That percentage goes down over time. People want democracy in 5 years, but not necessarily now. It is also true out of these polls that no leader, including Sistani, has a strong popular following, that some leaders like Ahmed Chalabi are deeply distrusted by large numbers of the Iraqi people. And then when we talk about democracy, this same poll raises a rather interesting point. 75% of the Iraqis polled, that's the largest percentage of people agreeing on virtually any issue, say they would never join a political party and oppose the existence of a political party. When you talk about people headed for democracy, and most of them don't want to be part of a political party, there is a question. Let me also note, in conclusion, a few things about the report most of you have, which is on what has happened in Iraq over a year of nation building. Our contracting effort was in deep trouble, far behind schedule before these events. We face inevitably a major crisis in trying to create a secure environment for contracting and for economic change. We have not demonstrated that we can manage these contracts. We have not shown that we can create integrators that can work with the Iraqis, get the money to the Iraqis efficiently. We are now forced into a situation where at least 20% of some $18 billion is now going to be spent on security personnel for the contractors, rather than on the contracts per se. And a lot of the progress that was achieved when the military were providing immediate aid where it was needed, a program called SURF, has now been delayed or broken up because we are attempting to administer what Iraq should be rather than deal with what Iraq wants to be. We face a need for a massive supplemental. Virtually everyone in Washington knows this. It will, for the military budget alone, be a minimum of $50 billion. If we add aid and external costs, that supplemental will probably be $70 billion. It is hard to see why we will not need it in 2006 and 2005. We have to face that reality, and we did not face it last night. Our information campaign, our efforts to influence the Iraqi people, has been an expensive disaster. Not only have we nothing to say, we are saying it on the wrong system. Repeaters using ground transmission when Iraq has voted for satellite television. If there is to be communication, it now must be Iraqis talking to Iraqis in spite of us and not because of us. Our security mission, which the President talked on, is 230,000 men recruited locally by people who have no reason to be loyal to us, among young men who need money and have little reason to be loyal to us or to anyone other than a local ethnic and security leader. We have failed in the contracting process to provide them with the equipment they need, with the communications, the transportation, the weapons, and the protection. And there is at this point in time no date certain at which we will solve those problems. In many cases, the contracting effort is not yet underway. We need those people, and we need them trained, and they cannot at this point be trained and equipped before late this fall, and that is months after the new government takes place. In short, we really do face a much more challenging struggle than was outlined last night. It is by no means hopeless, but a lot will depend on realism. And I would say, too, that that realism has to go beyond Iraq. What the President did not mention is the impact of the Arab-Israeli issue, which to me is as seminal as what we do in Iraq in influencing what happens in Iraq. We need Arab support, and we need a better image of what we should be. And I believe that the Greater Middle East initiative that he mentioned last night can also hurt us in Iraq, in the region. Because if the focus of that is liberty seen as a threat to friendly governments, rather than economics, demographics, evolutionary change, working with reformers in the region, it is one more indication of alienation and a failure to understand the region rather than to work with it and move forward. Thank you.
Tony, thank you very much. We'll come back to you, I'm sure, with a lot of questions. But we want to move on in our program to the rebuilding effort. You mentioned the fact that 20% of the $18 billion in the emergency supplemental for reconstruction will now have to be spent not on reconstruction but security for the contractors working. It's even worse than that in the sense that only $2 billion of that $18 billion has actually been obligated, not actually dispersed, as of last week. And the largest contractor, one of the largest contractors, I won't name the contractor, in Iraq right now, has threatened to pull out and has written a letter to the administrative AID threatening that because there's no flow of money. And with that kind of context, we want to invite Bathsheba Crocker, who is the co-director of our post-conflict reconstruction project, and one of the key persons really in the country thinking ahead to both the constituent parts of reconstruction efforts, defining success, building international consensus and support. And so we want to turn to Bathsheba for her thoughts right now.
Thank you, Patrick. It's always difficult to follow Tony, and especially when he's been so thorough. So I will try to touch on a few different points and keep my remarks short, and we can get into further detail in the discussion. I think, as Tony said, the president did renew his commitment last night, the United States commitment to stay the course in Iraq. I think what we didn't hear last night was what that really means in terms of a clear sense of a strategy for success in Iraq. And I think that strategy has to include more than us saying that we will stay the course there and that we will commit more troops if necessary and more money if necessary. What we still don't have, as we all know, is a clear path forward in terms of getting the key leaders in Iraq, who are the people who are shaping public opinion right now, to buy into the next iteration of the plan on the political transition front. And all we know is that Lakhdar Brahimi is there, and we are waiting for his word on what his plan might be. We have a firm commitment to June 30th, but we still don't know either what is supposed to happen on June 30th or what is supposed to happen after June 30th. And I think we run a serious risk of disaster in Iraq if what we find on June 30th is a turnover of sovereignty to some kind of governing body that lacks legitimacy. We will leave a real political vacuum in that country. And in the midst of this kind of civil strife and level of violence, I think that is a serious concern. I don't yet know what the plan is for avoiding that kind of disaster. It's also not clear to me what the plan is for making the next steps in the political transition process stick. And the president outlined some of those steps last night, the things that are included in the transitional administrative law. But what we have right now is a situation, at least in which the Shiites have not signed on to the transitional administrative law and are actually saying that they are against many of the key provisions in that law. And it's difficult for me to see how we keep that on track and move forward to elections by the end of the year. We clearly do need more international support and assistance in Iraq, not only in terms of more troops and more money, but also in terms of the real backing that has been missing in terms of giving this effort the international legitimacy that it needs. And I think that that's going to take more than just saying we're going to go back to the Security Council for another UN Security Council resolution. I think that will be an important piece of it. But I also think it's important for us all to remember that there have already been several post-conflict reconstruction era UN Security Council resolutions, and they have all purported to bless the efforts in Iraq, to authorize the U.S. plans in Iraq, and to authorize the strategy for going forward. But yet none of them have been successful in getting us the kinds of support that we still need in Iraq, and I'm not sure why just getting another UN Security Council resolution is going to do that. I think it's also important to remember that Secretary General Kofi Annan reiterated just yesterday that the UN isn't at all sure yet that it's prepared to take on the major mission that a lot of leaders in this country on both sides of the political aisle are now saying we want the UN to take on. And I think in that circumstance we need a plan B, and I'm not sure we yet have a plan B. As far as I can see, I think there are sort of three parallel tracks and perhaps equally important, although probably the one that I will speak of last is the most important, and that's what happens in Iraq itself. The first is that I think we need to really redouble and have a serious, committed diplomatic effort to get our key friends and allies on board here. And I think, again, that's going to mean more than just saying we're going to go back to the Security Council when the time comes. I think we should all be thinking seriously about Senator Biden's recommendation of setting up some kind of an international body that could provide the referee role that we will continue to need in Iraq after we turn over sovereignty. This doesn't mean we won't turn over sovereignty, but I think relying on just having a U.S. super embassy in Baghdad is probably not going to do the trick. I think we have all seen that at this point the U.S. lacks the leverage we need and the legitimacy we need in Iraq to really shepherd this political transition process through. Second, and I will really leave this to John, but I think the diplomatic efforts obviously have to include the regional countries, because the buy-in of the the regional countries will be key both in terms of security and political stability in Iraq. And I think in that regard, it was important that the President said last night that as a first step, Deputy Secretary Armitage will be going out to the region. And I think third, and again most important, is that we have to ensure that this political transition process becomes homegrown. What we've had thus far is a series of U.S. plans that have largely, or at this point fully, been scrapped because they haven't been accepted by the Iraqis. And I still see no real strategy in terms of getting the Iraqi buy-in and getting the key Iraqi moderate leaders in the country to sit down at a table and hash out a viable, clear, and credible process for moving forward on the political front. And again, the Shiites have so far said they do not accept key elements of the transitional administrative law. But yet all that we have heard from U.S. leaders is that we will continue to follow the steps outlined in that law. And I'm not exactly sure how that will happen in the absence of the support that it needs among the Iraqi people. And the final point I would make is on the security front, which is obviously, as we all know, key to any of this succeeding. I think, as Tony has said quite clearly, we are still at war in Iraq. We have been at war in Iraq since the beginning of the so-called reconstruction effort, and we have not been successful in ensuring security in this country from the beginning. It's something we clearly need to do. What does that mean in practice? One thing it means is we do need more troops, and the administration is recognizing this. We will be keeping some of the troops on the ground in Iraq. We may have to send more U.S. troops. I think that we also need to think about where are we going to get the significant commitments of troops from the major power countries that could provide real numbers and real fighting capacity that we need in Iraq. And I'm not sure, again, that just saying we need to sort of turn the Polish-led region into a NATO-led, the Polish-led operation into a NATO-led operation is necessarily going to do the trick in terms of getting the kinds of troop commitments we need, nor am I at all sure that NATO is quite there yet. In terms of disbanding the militias, so far what we're hearing the administration say is that we are going to go after Sadr's militia, and that's clearly an important and key step. But we have a problem with numerous militias in Iraq, and it's one of the things that we have not yet dealt with, and we need to start thinking about how we address all of those militias, because every one of them could pose a possible threat to the stability of the transition process. And I think finally, and as Tony talked about, we need far more serious efforts with the Iraqi security forces than we have seen so far. Thank you.
Well, Shiva, thank you. A very comprehensive, if brief, assessment. And we want to now turn to John Olterman, who directs our Middle East program. He's just back from the region, so he may be in a good position to give some advice to Deputy Secretary Armitage as he heads out there as to what he will be finding. John?
Thank you very much. Let me try to condense a little bit so we have time for questions. I think you've heard two excellent and comprehensive presentations, which I'll just try to add a little bit from what I heard in the region and where I think the region's head is. First of all, the Arab-Israeli conflict, as Tony suggested, remains the prism through which Iraq is seen. Despite the fact, and I think it's easy if you watch television here, you get the sense that Iraq is the biggest thing going on in the Middle East. In the Middle East, the biggest thing going on is still the Arab-Israeli conflict, and Iraq is seen as part of that. As Tony suggested, people draw clear parallels between occupations and intifadas, right? There are now two intifadas. There's the Al-Aqsa Intifada in Palestine and the Fallujah Intifada in Iraq, which they hope to spread. I think also the other part of this, which is often hard to see from the U.S., is the sense that people have that the failure of reconstruction in Iraq is a sign of malevolent U.S. intent, which you learn starting with the Arab-Israeli conflict, the U.S. position on the Arab-Israeli conflict, and Iraq reinforces. If the U.S. wanted reconstruction to go well, it would go well. The U.S. military was able to destroy the Iraqi military in less than 3 weeks. And if there's no electricity or people can't get food or there's no security, it's because Americans want Arabs to suffer. And that's the way people see it. And the Iraq thing fits into the Arab-Israeli peace rather than the other way around. On the ground in Iraq, from what I can tell and from the way people talk about it, the inability to provide security is a pervasive concern, the pervasive failure of Americans more than anything else. The responsibility of governments is to provide security. Iraqis, and you see this in some of the better reporting coming out of the region, when you really talk to Iraqis, they say, you know, the thing about the old regime is at least they provided security. And when you're terrified to go out at night, when you don't want to leave your house, when you don't want family members to leave your house, it has a horribly corrosive effect, and you feel like the government's not doing your job, especially when you can't figure out where the threat comes from. I mean, we've sort of seen how Israel has responded to security threats over time, and Iraqis transfer all of the blame for this to Americans. What this creates is an opportunity, as Shiva suggested, for a wide range of militias to do what the U.S. can't do. And then you start looking toward a Lebanon situation. We have a whole bunch of private militias, basically, you know, mafia groups, running operations in their individual areas, and you have a whole different political environment on the ground because of the inability to get the security right. Governments in the Middle East are starting to get nervous. You know, a lot of them said, we didn't want you to go in. We told you so. We said not to do it this way. And I think on the outset, they were pretty threatened by what the U.S. was talking about doing in Iraq. I mean, the U.S. was talking basically about Iraq destabilizing the Middle East in a positive way, of making authoritarian governments fall and creating liberty in their place. And they were happy that the U.S. was not going to be totally successful. But on the other hand, they didn't want the U.S. to be a total failure either, because chaos in Iraq, if Iraq were to become Afghanistan, as Afghanistan is once again becoming Afghanistan, if Iraq were to become Afghanistan, it's a bigger problem. Afghanistan's in the mountains. It's isolated. Iraq is a country with lots of resources right in the middle of everything. If Iraq became a crossroads of terrorism, you got problems in a lot of places. As a consequence, I think you're starting to see Arab governments see what they can do to be helpful. President Mubarak's offer this week to begin to train Iraqi police officers, I think, is a harbinger of Arab governments trying to at least staunch a complete failure in Iraq, because if it's a complete failure in Iraq, then I think there's a very broad sense that the people who are opposed to the U.S. presence in Iraq are just as opposed to all the Arab governments in the region, and we face a common problem. They're essentially being defensive in their interest in being more cooperative. And talk a little bit about Arab media, which Tony touched on. I was surprised there wasn't more of the Fallujah-like coverage a year ago during the war. I mean, war produces casualties and civilian casualties, and they often make excellent television. And we didn't really see as much of that as I had expected during the war. But I think part of that is that it was a much more crowded media environment. During the war, there were zillions of stories going around. And it was hard to come down to a single narrative. What we're seeing now is the Arab media is reporting a single narrative. And the narrative is about civilian suffering and resistance against overwhelming odds. And there's not so much else going on that's getting crowded out. And it's becoming a drumbeat, and it's gathering. And it is increasingly becoming the prism through which a whole swath of the world is seeing what's happening in Iraq. I think just to sort of wrap this up, it strikes me that if I were to describe the mood in the Middle East to you now, there's not a mood of questioning. I've been going back and forth to the Middle East a lot over a long period of time, and people often say, what's going on? What's going to happen? What do you really mean? And that's not where people are right now. People are saying, see, I'm going to explain to you how all this fits together. We know what you're like, and this is proof of what you're like. And it seems to me that the Middle East now is in a place where they feel that all their worst fears have been confirmed. And in many ways, it's hard to get into a conversation because they think they know the answer already. And that's going to make the task of building the diplomacy on this and building with our common interests on a whole range of issues with a whole range of people over the next coming years much more difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. We want to open up for questions from the audience. There are a couple of microphones, I believe, on either side. So if you want to stand up or raise your hand, we can give you a microphone. You can ask the panel a question. I wonder if I can just turn to Tony right now and just ask him again about the president's speech and press conference last night. He said at one point, Tony, that we are trying to change the world. You know, he's well aware of what's at stake here. And the question really is, you know, do we have a strategy for that change in terms of where we are going right now, in terms of just stepping back from the day-to-day fighting in Fallujah and so on, that gives us a sense that there can be a successful outcome?
To the extent I understood the strategy, it was one mention of the word liberty after another without explaining how we were going to have a greater Middle East initiative that could actually lead to solutions to economic problems, to demographic problems, to an explosion in the demand for jobs, to creating the institutions that make democracy possible, the rule of law, political parties, human rights. And it was in the context of a president who wasn't talking about a supplemental appropriation that would fund our operations in Iraq, much less money or support for any kind of operation outside it. So if there's a strategy there, it strikes me that we are now going to attempt for the rest of the Middle East the neoconservative strategy that we attempted for Iraq.
I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Clay Swisher. I work for CNO Resources. I'd like to ask the panel, there's been a wide body of reporting recently that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will seek some sort of letter of U.S. assurance that Israel will not have to withdraw to the Green Line and will be able to annex certain settlement blocks. And I'm wondering if the U.S. were to agree and provide this letter of assurance, what kind of message that would send vis-a-vis the situation in Iraq that, particularly as we say, we do not stand for occupation or colonization. If you could comment on that, please.
John, do you want to?
We're going to know what's in the letter in 3 hours. I don't know if you can write your report in the next 3 hours, but we're going to know what's in the letter in 3 hours. It's my guess that what is going to be there is something that's ambiguous enough for Ariel Sharon to go back to the Likud Central Committee and say, see, the Americans are really on our side. And for the administration to say, we said no such thing, our position remains unchanged. Because, as you know, the U.S. government never changes position on anything. it's always consistent. But we'll know exactly what the language is in 3 hours. So.
Other questions? Yes, Chris Nelson.
Normally, I'm a pessimist, so let me ask a potentially optimistic question. The point that you've been making is that the cumulative sense of the risks of failure may be producing the creation of what you could call the center that we have not had. If Mubarak and others are saying, you know, you guys are blowing it, but if you blow it really bad, that's going to hurt us. Moving it into Iraq, you could suggest that if the more senior Ayatollahs are starting to think about cooperating with us so that this youngster, this fellow that we still call a thug, doesn't become the norm, are we looking at a potential trend towards the creation of a center with which we can work? I think up to this point, what you've been saying is that we don't have that, that the average Iraqi and even the average Iraqi who might potentially have power has been sitting back waiting for us to do it or not do it. But do you see possibly a movement towards helping us do it because they all recognize that they'll all go down if they don't?
Tony, and maybe Sheba wants to add something.
Chris, it is a possibility, but centers emerge when you have both agreement among them and significant popular support. One of the problems in Iraq is after 30 years of dictatorship, there really is no figure that has emerged as being the center. No one in the governing council, in the few public opinion poll attempts that have been made, gets more than 5 to 6% recognition and support among the Iraqi people, and the support differs sharply by religious and ethnic affiliation. Sistani is not seen by most Iraqis, even though he's a leading cleric, as a leading political figure. It was about 5% in the public opinion polls. So as Sheba pointed out, we now have to watch these people emerge, and then they have to capture the attention of the people. And the center is going to be different for Sunni, Shiite, and Kurd. So you have to bring together a very wide range of people. Now, that kind of agreement is certainly possible, but it isn't a matter of having the senior Shiite leaders try to be pragmatic, they've been pragmatic from the start. Many of the problems that have emerged have been problems from the CPA side, not simply from the Shiite side. And I hope it's going to happen, but I don't see that we know as yet what is coming out of these last 2 weeks of crisis.
I mean, I think the thing that I would add to that is that we continue to have a vacuum. I mean, we went into Iraq, and when we said we were going into Iraq to depose the ruler and bring democracy, what in effect we've done is upset the ethnic and political balance of power in that country very profoundly. And what we've left in its wake is a vacuum. And one of the things that Tony said, which is so key to our failure here so far, is the fact that we have failed on the sort of public information operations, psyops front, whatever it is that you want to call it, so that although we have had opportunity to win over the so-called silent majority that still does exist in Iraq, we have not yet done so, and I think we're probably past the point where we can do so. And so the question is whether or not there are leaders who will emerge and whether the key leaders in all of the various communities will come together and start sort of charting this course forward. Their doing so will be key to this effort succeeding, and certainly it is the case, as Tony has pointed out in his writings, that if it turns out that instead the Shia majority, the moderate majority, goes with the Sadr camp, we have lost in Iraq.
Just pick up one of the implications of your question, which I think is very important, that this presents an opportunity for somebody to broker a deal between the U.S. and a whole range of parties in Iraq. So certainly there's a vacuum, but there are opportunities for people to emerge into that vacuum, which, as Shiva suggested, people haven't yet done. I think the other thing to be careful about is the sort of paint-by-numbers approach to Iraqi politics, that there are lots of different kinds of Shia, including some who say, I don't care if the guy's Shia or not, my wife is Sunni, whatever, plus people who say, my grandfather worked with his grandfather, and my father worked with his father. So it's not quite... Who are the Shia? There are lots of different Shia, some of whom don't care about being Shia at all.
Just a quick follow-up, if you don't mind. Thanks. In listening to the president last night, one of the points that he seemed to make, but it got sort of lost, was I thought I heard him say, you know, I'm waiting on this UN guy to come up with something, and I'm going to go along with whatever he says. But I'm not sure he quite put it that plainly, and at that hour of the night with the dog yelling for his walk and all that, I'm not sure I got it either. But what did you hear him say about waiting for the UN representative to come up with something and then we'd go with it?
Let's be very careful here. The UN representative has tried now for well over 6 weeks to broker a compromise. He may succeed. But that compromise is in the context of a whole set of rules, procedures, definitions of the U.S. role. It isn't simply a political compromise. It has to deal with this is power brokering with the U.S. still being there with over 100,000 troops and a massive embassy and a flow of $16 billion worth of aid. And however successful he may be in getting Iraqis to talk to Iraqis, he can't make the decision for the Iraqis any more than we can. It is important to have brought in the UN, but again, it's the Iraqis that make the decision, not the UN negotiator or the CPA.
Chris, I would just add to that. I mean, as somebody who's worked with Lakhdar Brahimi over the years, I mean, he has enormous following. I think the president's undoubtedly been advised that, you know, this is the best next hope that the United States has to lighten its burden, frankly, in Iraq with the coming of Iraqi sovereignty in the beginning of July. This is now the new opportunity that really wasn't seized earlier in terms of building out the coalition, because this gives the sovereign Iraqi entity a chance to accept international support from quarters that it hasn't been receiving. And that is a very important hope if this is to move forward and gain legitimacy despite all the problems. We have a question right down here.
Thanks. I'm Vanka LaFleur. I'm a visiting fellow here, and I thought all three of you gave terrific presentations, so thank you. I was reassured to hear Tony Cordesman say that we are not facing a major insurgency yet in Iraq, and I wondered then if the president's talk last night of the authority to use decisive force, against insurgents and talk of killing and capturing al-Sadr. And if I understood what I read in the paper this morning, the troops on the ground now have the authority to shoot any man on the street at night, whether he's armed or not. Are these measures counterproductive? And if so, what would be a better solution to the violence they face?
Your tactical rules of engagement are highly localized and somehow confusing what takes place in a tactical encounter in Fallujah with what takes place nationwide is very dangerous. You do, when you fight urban warfare against insurgents, what you have to do. And war is about killing, not about some sport where there are rules which establish neat reservations. If you start getting into combat, there is only so much you can do to be politically sensitive and fight politically. That's one reason for the ceasefire and to attempt political negotiations. But I have not seen a generalization. Perhaps the president was a little too dramatic in what he said. This is a highly localized set of rules where each fight is tailored to the specific conditions where we're deploying combat troops. We're not going nationwide with changes in the way we're fighting or in our rules of engagement. We aren't ignoring the political dimension of the conflict. Whether it works is uncertain. We haven't seen negotiation work in Fallujah. We do not know whether we can effectively get more insurgents than we create. That's one of the major uncertainties there, and it's exactly the same situation if we get into firefights or military action against Sadr, because you will not know precisely what the tactical situation is. You certainly are going to be politically sensitive, but once you start it, you can't always control the outcome.
Sheba, John, do you want to add?
I might just add briefly that I think, you know, we're obviously in an incredibly difficult environment here, because I think we are faced at the same time with the fact that not doing these kinds of offensive operations that we need to do and not being forceful in going after the thugs and assassins or whatever you want to call them makes us look weak in a population where we don't want to look weak. At the same time, we're faced with the kinds of things that John was talking about, which is that we have the eyes of the Arab media watching us very closely and picking up every time there is a civilian casualty. But I think it's also important to recognize, and one of the things that came out in the newspapers this morning, is that we're talking about, one of the things that we're talking about in Fallujah is getting the bad guys handed over who killed the four contractors a few weeks ago and bringing them to justice. And the bringing them to justice piece has actually been a missing piece all along. So that we have been rounding up a lot of people in Iraq, but what the Iraqis have not yet seen is any of these people moving through an Iraqi justice system, any of them being brought to justice. And so there is a little bit of a culture of impunity, and I think it will be very important that we start actually following through on that piece of it.
Yes, sir, here in the aisle.
Arthur Houghton, former State Department, former NSC. I'd like to go to your darkest thoughts and ask about Plan B. The administration is unlikely to know when the risk of, I'm trying to recall the word that you used, of the risk of failure seems imminent. At least it would be unlikely to let us know when it believes that the risk of failure is imminent. When would we send General Gromov in? Withdraw the troops, turn out the lights. What are the indicators that you would look toward that the situation has reached such a point, recognizing that that is a long way from where we are today?
Well, first, we have a series of political events between now and when the elected government takes over in 2006. But legally, we become an embassy on June 30th. If any of the governments that emerge ask us to leave, I would see no basis whatsoever for us doing anything else politically or in international law. And that is a possibility, not on June 30th, but over time. If you get a significant civil war, if the image is one of a country you cannot help, then withdrawal is in many ways also going to be inevitable. The question of what is a large-scale civil war is something you have to see play out if it happens. If, as Sheba pointed out, you lose the Shiites to the point where you are dealing not perhaps with an insurgence, but massive public demonstrations which oppose your presence in the country, those demonstrations by themselves are a warning that you will have to leave. Now, I want to be very careful about those cases because none of them at this point is happening, and none of them at this point immediately seems likely. They are just possibilities over time. But I think these are the circumstances under which we would leave, and I think one has to be very careful here about the consequences. Would this be a serious strategic and political reversal for the United States? Yes, it would. Would it embarrass critical allies that have stood with us, like Britain, Australia, Italy, and other countries? Yes, it would do that too. Would it take us years to recover our credibility, at least at the level we had when we started that? That's true as well. We've already seen in Vietnam, in Lebanon, and in Somalia that when being forced to leave is the product not of your own lack of resolution or will, but the fact you no longer can accomplish your goal with any credibility, the strategic costs, while high, are certainly acceptable. So there is not a desirable exit strategy, just an exit strategy that we can live with.
Mm-hmm. Good question. Yes. Yes, sir, right here on the end.
John Mulligan, while we're on that topic of dark thoughts, the president last night disparaged the Vietnam analogy. What do panelists think about that parallel? Where does it work? Where does it fall down? And if it's irrelevant, what are some other historical events to which we can compare this?
Mm-hmm. Tony, you've studied both wars very closely. How do you summarize?
I really worry about the analogy. First, some obvious factors. We're not dealing with massive external powers supporting the insurgents. We're not really fighting a foreign enemy as we were North Vietnam. We do not have a situation where we have lost a majority of the population as we did in Vietnam and we lost the Buddhists. We are not attempting to get around the reality of a need to create a legitimate government, which we did after the fall of Diem. We certainly have a far more professional and skilled and realistic military, and we have a more realistic nation-building effort without all of the problems of the pacification campaign. But the real problem we face here, and is similar to Vietnam, is it is a draining, uncertain counterinsurgency campaign mixed with armed nation-building, not post-conflict, with vast political uncertainty. And there is the possibility that regardless of all our military skill, our combination of political capability, economic capability, is not going to create a country that we can help or transform. Now, beyond that, you know, the nice thing about military history is I can go on to the Peloponnesian War, the reconstruction in the Civil War, or the Crimea, and all of them will have some parallel. The danger here is we're fighting this war, not the last one or the one before that.
Tony, I wonder if I can just throw in a question on that, though, in terms of we also face uniquely right now a sense of insecurity even in the homeland, and the 9/11 Commission reminds us of that on a daily basis. I mean, this is iffy history, but I mean, to what extent could another serious terrorist attack affect thinking in Iraq, and how would that be factored in? Just another front?
I think one of our great problems, one of the things we have to be very careful about, is creating the idea that there is some unified terrorist threat that's operating in Afghanistan, Iraq, and then can operate in the United States. There are certainly links between the elements. But everything would depend, frankly, Pat, on what was the target, how was the attack carried out, what's the context of the events in Iraq at the time, what are the politics here. Historically, Americans do not intimidate well, and a terrorist attack might well have just the opposite effect as it did in Madrid. That is, it would make Americans more angry, more resolute, and more committed. But that's an easy thing to say because I haven't seen the events and I don't know the context, and I think the speculation gets to be not necessarily dangerous, but you just don't have good answers.
Indeed.
Patrick, if I might just add one thing on to answer the question. I think I agree with everything that Tony said, and I think, though, that your question really gets to, again, the importance of the political transition process and what happens in terms is sort of going forward, June 30th and after June 30th, because I think the one lesson that is key here for the post-June 30th period is that we have seen from Vietnam that the U.S. military, we will fail if what we're trying to do is prop up a government that has no popular legitimacy. And that just points out, again, the importance of getting to some kind of political situation in Iraq which does have some popular legitimacy. I'm not sure that we're there yet, but that's why I am so concerned about what is going to happen over the next several months in terms of getting to June 30th.
I would add one other point. There's a problem here with the word legitimacy. It's fascinating to get interested in politics and in June 30th. But for most Iraqis, legitimacy is how well are things administered on the ground? Do you have jobs? Do you have security? Is the process of government actually working? Having a wonderful new leader who gives brilliant speeches over television is all very fine. Now, the problem here is we're not going to have that administrative structure on June 30th. We probably aren't going to have it by November, at least in terms of effective Iraqi security forces and solving all of the local issues. And we all need to understand that building this government in terms of what matters most to most people in the country, in one sense is beginning now as we turn power over to the ministries, and in another sense is something that's going to go on 4 months after June 30th, and where the Iraqis are going to be often much more interested in the practical result as it affects their daily life than what leader shows up on their television set.
I know Sheba Crocker is going to have to take off for another meeting, but I think I need to go to the very back, yes, in the middle.
Yes, hi, Greg Aftan, dealing with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. My question is for John, and I'd like to pick up a point you made about your travel in the region and the perception that from the leaders and from the people there that things are very chaotic in Iraq and are getting worse. Is it your perception that the concern is that this would give ferment to the radicals in these countries and that the regimes themselves are worried about their own political stability? Or is it more of a concern that Iraq could break up as a state and that you could have outside forces come in and create a chaos that way? How do you sort of weigh those two?
As I understood it, it was the former, that first of all, it could be a sort of way station for the bad guys, in the way Afghanistan was. And second, that it would be an inspiration that people propped up by the U.S. don't always win. And considering the fact that I think all the governments in the Middle East, and this extends from our friends to the ball bearings on the axis of evil, as I like to call some of them, feel that they really need the U.S. on the counterterrorism stuff. And Iraq going really, really bad makes their counterterrorism fears internally much, much more severe than they already are, and they're already pretty severe.
A lot of hands here, but right here in the front.
We spent a lot of time talking about all of the challenges and, quote, failures of where we've gotten to date. Are there any benefits that have come out of anything that the current administration has done to date? And number two, given that both our current president and the president competitor for that position, are not suggesting that we cut and run. What realistically, if you were advising the current administration to adjust its approach, or a new administration coming in, what realistically, given that both are committed to seeing this thing through in one way, shape, or another, are the realistic opportunities that we could take to try to turn this around or to advance it in a more positive direction?
It's a fair enough question. We're not here to be Pollyannas, though, and we're here to sort of assess the situation where we are today. We have spoken on the record in the past on many occasions about the pluses and minuses, and Tony's going to, I think, address this question right now about some of the
successes. There's a pretty significant number of areas where the aid program has made progress, and they're described in the report that was outside when you came in. In case after case, there needs to be a major reorganization and restructuring of the aid and the contracting effort. You're going to have to do that on security grounds alone. But far too often, for a variety of reasons, some of them imposed by the Congress, you have very complex administrative structures where we are trying to impose an economic solution, even in areas like power generation, on Iraq rather than meet what the Iraqis want, where our contracting procedures are extremely cumbersome. Pat pointed out the obligation. Obligation doesn't matter a damn, because until it's doing something and you actually have an achievement visible, it just doesn't matter. One thing the administration could do would be to stop telling us what the inputs are to the aid process and give us clear measurements of what is real progress seen by the Iraqis, and to really take a hard look at whether legislative relief is needed to get the contracting procedure working. Another would be to revitalize the SURF program so the military could go back to providing immediate relief directly to the Iraqis in large amounts, because a lot of this is how the presence is seen on the ground. The series of events that led to not providing the equipment needed by the Iraqi military and the contracting problems and failures in providing transportation, weaponry, protection, and communications gear to the security forces is absolutely critical to fix, and the president hinted at that. It should never have developed in the first place. There is simply no excuse for the sequence of events which has affected this situation, and there is no excuse for not giving that the highest possible priority to fix it. I think that one of the other things that is really needed, because we have a transition coming to an embassy, is to go back and take a look almost from the ground up. Given the risks of insurrection, is the current plan for the embassy adequate? Will it create a workable approach to staffing? And can it work with the Iraqis so they can administer and actually support government operations? These are all points that have to be added to the ones that Chiba made earlier. I think on the information level, to be blunt, it is hopeless. At this point in time, we cannot create something we do not have, which is a group of people who know how to talk to the Arab world. And that simply is something which is going to have to depend on the Iraqis. I think the other key issue is to perhaps be a little franker to the American people about what the costs are going to be in American life and money. Everybody needs to agree the supplemental has to be spent, that it has to be provided, that we don't delay or create more problems for ourselves because it is embarrassing to ask for money between now and November. And I don't think there's anyone on the Hill or anyone in the administration that doesn't know this is coming or that believes there is any alternative.
The only thing I would add to that is I think if we've learned one thing from all of the post-conflict reconstruction or nation-building efforts or whatever you want to call it that we've seen of late, it's that if you don't have the security piece of it right, nothing else is going to work. And I think it is true to point out that there has probably been progress. There has definitely been progress in certain areas. But at this point in time, and I think this has actually been the case for some time now, the security problems have overshadowed everything else that is going on, and they also undermine efforts across the board on every other front. And we have committed that if the generals ask for more troops in the field, they will get more troops. I think we have to be constantly reassessing what it's really going to take to bring security, because even if you say that the number of insurgents is small, and even if you say that as a military matter it is not strategically significant, it is significant in terms of your efforts on the nation-building front. And until we get that piece of it stabilized, we're going to have real trouble in the rest of it.
John, do you want to add something?
No.
Yes, sir, in the back.
Thank you. Josh Rogan, Asahi Shimbun. This question is for Mr. Altman. What is your impression, based on your observations, of cooperation between Sunni and Shiite resistance groups in Iraq, especially since the assault on Fallujah began? And for the entire panel, how is the new policy of abductions of civilians in Iraq going to bear out, and what will its impact be on any attempt to further internationalize the occupation? Thank you.
When I was in the Middle East, I didn't speak to either Sunni or Shia resistance groups. So I'm not sure how well I can answer that. As a general principle, I'd point out what Tony has often told me, which is it's quite possible for two different people to hate the same person. The fact is, I think, that you're going to see some tactical cooperation. One of the nice things, I think, from the perspective of these groups is that Americans in Iraq are color-coded. They're often wearing green. And it's pretty easy to pick out American soldiers. And that's something where, you know, they can agree on the goal. They just don't agree on what comes after. But the short-term goal for a lot of these groups is the same, which is to end the foreign presence in Iraq. And I think this latest string of kidnappings is quite clearly and narrowly directed at de-internationalizing the conflict and making it a battle of Iraqis against Americans, which the Iraqis feel comfortable that in their own domestic political context they can win.
Let me pick up on what John said. One of the problems we face here is we tend to forget our own calendars. Since really August of last year, the incident report has been that there have been about 150 to 180 attacks, incidents, IEDs a week going on. The frequency doesn't change all that much. There's a more detailed report. It isn't published, but occasionally you see parts of it. And you've got about 30 to 40 incidents of low-level violence a day. And that's been going on now, again, since August. This is a real war. It's not something where all of a sudden we see, gee, there are kidnappings. Before then, we saw people killed as international civil servants or in NGOs. We saw bombings of embassies. We saw the UN headquarters attacked. We saw people killed in convoys. Now we have a different technique, and we've gone to taking hostages. Before then, it was desecrating bodies. You're going to find every mechanism you can as a hardcore insurgent to create the worst political and psychological image you can. Sometimes you'll take the hostages and let them go because that gives you media and political leverage. Sometimes you're going to find their bodies burned and deliberately desecrated in front of television. And when that doesn't work, you're going to go on to the next series of techniques which can grab media attention, because you've got a menu that's been developed since the early 60s of how to do this. And you go through cycles of these patterns. This is political and psychological war, and the rules are you do anything you can in asymmetric war, regardless of how others may judge the value system that you're using. And that is particularly true if you're talking some of the truly hardline Islamists, some of which are certainly are from the outside. Now, what can we do about this? There is no way in the near term that we can protect contractors, NGOs, UN personnel, or even American men and women in uniform or those of our allies as they move. There will be continuing levels of casualties, and people will try to manipulate this politically. And we've got to get used to it. This is how asymmetric warfare is fought. And it won't just be fought this way here. It hasn't been fought that way in the past, and we're going to see it in many other cases in other countries and places in the future.
It is possible, just to add to that very quickly, the empirical point that civilian aid workers in Iraq and Afghanistan have been increasingly targeted. As Tony said, nobody is off limits in this kind of warfare, but they have been, the numbers actually speak to this. And given the paper that you work for in terms of Japan, you've got one of our staunchest allies of Iraq policy of the United States heavily and deeply committed in supporting this. And if they have not faced any casualties in Japan as of yet over Iraq, and this will be a fundamental distinction, if those hostages that are the Japanese trio are killed, this could obviously create a political firestorm that could eventually topple even a very strong prime minister in Japan. Who knows how this could unravel? That is certainly one of the fears. We have time for a couple more questions, and then we are going to have to break. Yes, sir. That's good, John. Two more, no?
I'd like to ask just another, if I may, for Mr. Cordesman. This past summer, we saw a lot of rhetoric, both from the far right in this country and also the neoconservatives who promoted this war to begin with, that that the focus should have been on Syria and the cross-border foreign jihadist movements that were causing us trouble in Iraq because of Syria. I'm wondering to what extent we could predict or we could forecast that Iran will be on our sights, particularly if the situation with the Shia community continues to deteriorate. There's been reports in Al Jazeera today that their foreign minister was saying that there was some contact made and some requests for assistance. Could you add to that or kind of give us your assessment on where things might head with Iran?
Well, it isn't just Iran. Obviously, the Shiite problem spills over into Iran, but the Kurdish problem and the Turkmen problem spills over into Turkey. Arab states, as John pointed out, are going to look at the Iraq both in terms of unity as an Arab country and, at least to some extent, as a Sunni country. And as the political situation in Iraq works out, those external powers on Iraq's borders are going to play part of the game. Now, if we get upset about this and about the fact Iran acts out its vital interests in Iraq without seeing clear evidence that it's threatening to us, we're going to be in a very difficult position, just as if we reject the Turks or the Arabs. But I haven't seen any evidence of this yet. And, you know, it isn't just the Arab world which has conspiracy theories. We're pretty good at it ourselves.
Very good. Sir, you will have the last question.
Otto Kreischer, Copy News Service. I want to go back to a question that was asked earlier about the problem of crushing the insurgency or not. The question, you know, is if we go after Sadr in Najaf, holy area for the Shia, and or if we go into Fallujah with, you know, Arab television already reporting, you know, showing these gruesome pictures of civilians, women and children being killed, you know, What is the trade-off, you know, in showing our force militias getting rid of the major insurgents, but then losing the international propaganda war?
Well, it's a very good question, but it is one that I'm sure General Abizaid and every brigade and division commander in the country deals with all the time, and probably every battalion and company commander as well. And it is precisely for that reason that you're not going to see people suddenly ignore the political dimension of warfare.
And you're not going to go out and try to crush the insurgents because you know you can't crush them. You may get a large number of people in a given town, but an awful lot of them simply disappear into the town or the countryside. So every battle and every tactical engagement has to be a matter of what is the objective of that engagement and what are the political dimensions. And I think, too, that there's another side of this, and I've noticed it over time. It does. If you get exactly the same amount of reporting about large-scale civilian casualties without anybody checking out the facts, almost regardless of what you do, you can't do anything to stop it. But some of the numbers that people are generating and some of the images that people are making make absolutely no sense at all. I think that it is critical here that you get an objective and accurate media and you just don't run out talking about excessive uses of force or large-scale casualties or civilians being caught up in firefights without attention to the rules of engagement unless you can actually justify those facts as distinguished from getting it from somebody in Baghdad providing a rumor that they can't substantiate. We can't avoid the images of war, but I don't think that question is one that anybody in uniform in the United States or Britain or among our allies is not constantly conscious of with every tactical action they take.
John, a final word?
I mean, just the parallel here is obviously to Jenin, where the final casualties turned out to be 10% of what they were reported to contemporaneously, and it's very hard in this situation to report it. I think the other issue, which we haven't really talked about, Tony raised with the whole greater Middle East idea, is that a real mess in Iraq makes a lot of people who think there needs to be change in the Arab world say, well, yeah, there needs to be change, but you can't trust the U.S. to do it right, that the U.S. would go into Iraq and leave a mess in its wake and then pull out. So I think a sort of an element to keep in mind is that there is a hope that a real success, a slam dunk success in Iraq would be a beacon of hope and inspiration to the region. But something that looks really bad would also make people extraordinarily skeptical about listening to U.S. assurances about how you have to embrace change, you have to open your markets, you have to open the political system, because we're going to be with you into the future. They're going to say, no, you're going to do what you did in Iraq. So you get rid of the people you don't like, and you leave chaos in the wake. And it relates to the problem of building confidence in our intentions that I think is going to be something that we're not going to be able to do in a month or a year, but we're going to have to make one of our tasks in the longer range as we think about our future in the Middle East.
I'm afraid that concludes this session. We'll be back hopefully soon with the help of our External Affairs Office. Thank you, John. Thank you, Tony.